This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. Months into the pandemic, we're starting to resume schedules that resemble normalcy, but a lot has changed. Today, we're going to examine various aspects of our food supply system with particular attention to meat production. Outbreaks of COVID-19 in several packing plants across the country raised concern about the meat supply. Pork was hit hard when a big Smithfield processing plant in Sioux Falls was shut down after hundreds of workers got sick. In an excerpt from South Dakota Public Radio's In the Moment, host Laurie Walsh talks with Bill Even, CEO of the National Pork Board, in a discussion about the meat supply chain.
Bill Even, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori.
All right. I want to talk about this because much of our reporting has been about people, particularly consumers, sort of realizing for the first time when there were limits or rations on pork products or prices went up or all of a sudden they couldn't get bacon, that something had gone wrong, and they associated it with the closure of the Smithfield processing plant after an outbreak that made national news of coronavirus among plant workers. And then what we're hearing from pork producers is that, you know, this is a problem that was a long time coming. So give us a little history into what some of the problems were that many people are now just waking up to.
Sure. Thanks, Lori. And so I may be speaking from my point of view as a farmer and growing up in our family operation at Humboldt. You think about where we were, say, at the end of World War II. And people had come out of the Great Depression where they were worried about having enough money. They were worried about food availability. We went through World War II, and there was whole-scale destruction around the world of literally people starving to death. And the United States, whether through the Marshall Plan and helping rebuild Europe and work that we did in Asia, as well as work we did here in the United States, was we decided that we were blessed with an abundance of good government, of good soil, good rainfall, productive farmers, that we could build a food system that was going to be able to provide safe, abundant, affordable food for not only U.S. citizens, but to really help people avoid starvation around the world. And that food system has led to incredible lengthening of life expectancy globally. It's helped with educational attainment in people around the world, and that they've just had more nutrition available. And when you fast forward from, say, 1945 to, say, the year 2000, we realized that the system that we had built was starting to get have questions asked of it. And those questions, Lori, really started to turn into, safe, abundant, affordable food with table stakes. We just expect that out of if you're American or live in the Western world. But we're asking, what about sustainability? What about animal welfare? What are we doing to protect our workers, both on the farms and in the food system? And we've been having these discussions, I guess you could lump them under sustainability now, for probably the past 15, 20 years. And the COVID pandemic has really refocused everybody's attention on this, Lori, and that, oh my gosh, we've got farmers that are having to destroy produce or dump milk, or in extreme cases having to euthanize animals because they can't get to the consumer. We've got the food system breaking down in the middle, and then you've got consumers worried, am I going to be able to get meat and vegetables in my grocery store? And so here we are today, focused on first principles, and we're asking ourselves, what type of food system do we want? And I think that's where I'd start the conversation.
You said the food system we built has flaws. What went wrong?
So I would characterize this as, like anything else that you put under pressure, you're going to find weak links in it. So you think about like a rope or maybe a log chain. So you've got a chain, and when you put pressure on it, if you're trying to pull somebody out of the snowbank in the road ditch in South Dakota, weaker links in that can give out. And anytime you stress a system, it doesn't matter if it's in the food system or if it's in manufacturing or if it's even the strength of the deck you've built on the backside of your house, you're going to find weak points. And I think what we found here is the weak point in understanding how do we move food from the farm to the consumer in a fashion that meets some basic principles. We mentioned the food has to be safe. We know that animal welfare needs to be taken care of. Public health needs to be protected. And the environment needs to be protected in this process. These things, Lori, I think what we found is that all of them have to work together. And if you emphasize one to the detriment of any of the others, you're going to have bad outcomes. So in other words, if you ignore animal welfare, you're going to have animals that aren't healthy and potentially could lead to food safety problems. If you ignore public health, you're going to have food safety or workers that don't feel comfortable or safe going to their jobs. And all of these things need to work in a coordinated fashion. And I think what we saw, Lori, was that things fell out of their coordinated fashion, and there were people making decisions only on one proof point rather than thinking about this as a food system.
Some people have argued that, you know, once Smithfield workers go back to work, you get those lines moving again. You maybe make them move a little bit faster. We make up for lost time. Nothing needs to change. Other people are saying that would be a mistake. Lots needs to change, and we need to get started on it. What are your thoughts about what needs to change? What's most urgent that needs to be addressed right now?
These are big questions, and I would say the most urgent thing that the food system faces now is ensuring the safety and health of everybody. It doesn't matter if you're a farmer, if you're working in a feed mill, if you're working in a barn, if you're driving a truck, whether it's a truck hauling animals or a truck bringing the food to the grocery store, or you're working in the food system. It doesn't matter if you're working at Hy-Vee or Fairway or John Morrell or Kraft Foods or a dairy plant, the expectation is that you need to make sure that the public health piece is managed inside of that. The one advantage that the executive order brought, the Defense Production Act that the administration put into play here a couple of months ago, is all that order did was prioritize personal protective equipment and testing for the food industry. And when you think about that, priority number one is always our hospitals, first responders, and folks that need to have the PPE to keep themselves safe. And then there was the Wild West outside of all of that. And what the executive order did to help with the first priority, Lori, was to move the food industry up as an essential, a critical infrastructure so that they could get the PPE necessary to make their workers feel safe and comfortable going back to work.
Longer term, what are some of those conversations? How do we avoid getting in this place again?
Well, I think one of the things that's being talked about a lot is the supply chains and the links of supply chains, whether they're global or intrastate or even interstate. That's a big discussion that's happening right now in the industry as everybody starts to double check and say, what's the best cost system that I need to build? That's different than a least cost system, but a best cost system says, okay, I'm going to need to have some slack in the chain, some resilience inside of a system here. Now, that's going to come with a cost. Anytime that you take efficiencies out of a system, whether it's how you're feeding your animals or how the route that the UPS truck takes to your house, there are trade-offs there. You're either going to burn more fuel, you're going to burn more feed and energy, you're going to add impacts to climate change, or I think for your consumer listeners, you're going to add cost. And you have to be comfortable adding the minimal amount of cost to take care of the problem, which in this case is resiliency. And the one advantage that we've had in the Western world is we've been able to produce food relatively efficiently and at a very affordable prices that, frankly, that's freed up disposable income that's allowed people to build better homes, buy a third car, buy extra flat screen TVs. That money has gone elsewhere into the economy and help build and grow the economy because you haven't had to spend it on food. I think the question in front of us, Lori, is are people willing to spend more money on food to have certain attributes or resiliency baked into the system. And ultimately, in a free market economy, they're going to vote with their pocketbook. We can build a system that may meet your resilience goals, but it's going to come with some trade-offs in the form of higher cost, or in some cases, less efficiency that could increase, for example, climate change impacts. There's no free lunch, I guess is what I'm saying, Lori.
Talk a little bit about confined animal feeding operations in pork production, because people started thinking more deeply about that. 900 hogs in a barn. We've got lots of land here. Why can't they be outside for a while? Is the system of CAFOs contributing to the pressure that is put on producers and to the fragility of the system?
I think the answer to that is no. And again, I put on my farmer hat, and we raise cattle now, but we grew up raising hogs as well. And the reality is, the term CAFO is more of a bureaucratic term. The reality is, it's a barn. Put horses in a barn, you can put cattle in a barn, you can put milk cows in a barn, you can put pigs in a barn, you can put chickens in a barn. I grew up as a little kid. My father had hogs that were indoors and outdoors. And disease problems and weather-related problems that we had with pigs, they don't have a hair coat like, say, cattle do or horses do that can withstand the harsh weather, certainly in the Dakotas. And so what we slowly did over the years is we brought our hogs onto concrete and had some indoor-outdoor operations. And ultimately, your goal is to bring them inside where you've got them in a climate-controlled environment year-round. And it's better for the health of the welfare of the animal. And this isn't a criticism. You can still raise hogs outdoors. My father did. I did. But when you think about what are those trade-offs, there are some trade-offs in those systems. And where we're at as a nation in raising pigs is that we've got a cross-section of folks that raise pigs in every imaginable approach. Some use huts out on pastures, others use modified indoor-outdoor facilities, and some use all indoor facilities. Ultimately, if you're thinking about how am I going to take care of the welfare of the animals, it's going to boil down to the husbandry of the people that are caring for the animals. Outdoor ones need to be bedded more. They need to be protected from the cold and protected from the heat. Indoor ones need to be managed differently. You need to make sure there's adequate room in the barn in order for the animals to get access to feed and water. I could say, in my experience, it's somewhat been easier when I've worked in a barn because you can interact with the pigs in that type of a setting. But we believe in choice, I guess, Lori. We're not here to dictate a style or an approach, but rather, are you taking care of your animals regardless of where they're being housed?
Before I let you go, what do you want to leave consumers with? Because I think what a lot of people are hearing, if we look at solutions to the problems that have been exposed because of the virus, a lot of the answer comes to price and consumers being willing to pay more for what they put on their table. Is it that simple? How should people who are just walking through the grocery store thinking about this think about what they can do? How can they be part of making the system better?
Wonderful question. Less than 2% of the American public is involved in agriculture, and so we think of everybody else. You're our consumers, right? You're our customers. We take pride in growing crops and animals, provide food for not only the U.S., but other places around the world. I would answer your question in saying that the food is here. It is available. The real issue is there's no silver bullet to any of us. There are trade-offs. And so when you think about designing your food system, we got to sit down as a nation and decide, here are the things that we would like in our food system. Here are the trade-offs that will happen with that. And then here's what this is going to cost. One thing I know that's in the front of mind of a lot of people now is the current recession that we're in. Record unemployment. We haven't seen this level of unemployment since the Great Depression. And these are very real things that you can have a food system with all kinds of bells and whistles, and it's going to have high cost. And what does that mean to those folks that maybe are out of a job or can't afford it? And on the flip side, you don't want a system that's so lowest common denominator that you're trading off or impacting animal welfare or food safety or the environment. There's an old joke that for every complex problem, there's a simple answer, but it's completely wrong. I think the biggest risk for your listeners and consumers is to think there's one simple answer to this, and the reality is we have to sit around the table and look at this as a system, understand the trade-offs, and then let's make a decision together. That's how we do things in the U.S.
Bill Even is CEO of the National Pork Board. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting host Lori Walsh in a discussion with Bill Even, CEO of the National Pork Board. Next on Main Street, the safety of workers in the meat processing industry.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. Income inequality is bad for the poor, sure, but do you know that it's also bad for the rich? In fact, it turns out that the more egalitarian societies are stronger, healthier, and happier across the board. On our next episode, we'll explore why this is. So join me and my guest Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett for Why Does Income Equality Make Societies Stronger? On the Next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Many of Nebraska's COVID-19 hotspots are meatpacking plants and their communities with deep immigrant roots. However, many workers have avoided speaking out about the toll of the pandemic during the crisis because, as Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports, they fear losing their jobs. As a result, it's up to their children to organize for them.
Nguyen Yeo is a lawyer in New York City, but she grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and moved there with her family from Vietnam as a kid. Her dad got a job at the Smithfield plant in nearby Crete. These days, it's the biggest employer in town. She says she remembers the sound of his alarm clock going off.
Sometimes I was having, like, I had a bout of insomnia that evening or that night, and I didn't fall asleep, but then my dad's alarm would go off, you know, and I would see him get up while I hadn't even gone to bed yet.
He still wakes up before dawn for work. And over his 27-year-long career, she says he's kind of become an institution. He mentors young employees new to the job and is close with his managers, close enough to bring back trinkets when he attended his daughter's graduations.
Every time we go on vacation, which we never do, he'll always want to buy something for his manager.
But even as a massive COVID-19 outbreak has gripped the plant with hundreds of reported cases, she says her dad doesn't talk about it much. That's not new behavior.
They've just put their head down, and that's helped them survive.
Many children of meatpacking workers say their parents are still scared of getting COVID-19, but also worry about getting fired for speaking out. Several companies, like Smithfield, have issued statements highlighting their pandemic policies, claiming they meet or exceed recommendations. But advocates have alleged many plants still aren't socially distancing workers and don't have enough PPE. Plus, some companies like Tyson still don't offer fully paid sick leave, despite recommendations from OSHA. Those concerns recently brought Myra Mendez, an organizer with the advocate group Children of Smithfield, to the steps of Nebraska's Capitol building.
I stand as a proud daughter of two meatpacking plant workers who immigrated to this country over 30 years ago with a single purpose, to provide the best for our family.
She told a crowd of dozens that plants are a critical presence in many of Nebraska's immigrant communities, employing thousands.
These meatpacking plants have made it possible for our parents to put us through college, but we won't allow employers and government officials to classify plant workers as essential workers without treating them as essential lives.
Two-thirds of those workers are immigrants, and many of them are Latino. The state doesn't specifically report these numbers, but advocates say immigrants working at plants, particularly Latino immigrants, have been disproportionately hit by outbreaks. Statewide, Latinos make up almost half of Nebraska's COVID cases.
This is a deeply immigrant community that is uplifting local economies and putting food on the table.
That's Tony Vargas, who represents a lot of plant workers from South Omaha in the Nebraska legislature. He says the state should have done more outreach earlier on.
It took weeks for us to get Spanish language education material in certain places, let alone at the state level.
Vargas's parents moved to New York City from Peru in the 70s and worked on factory lines. His dad eventually became a machinist, an essential job, just like the workers at Smithfield. He worked until the day he got sick with COVID and died a few weeks later at 72.
He relished the American dream. If it wasn't for the American dream, I think he would have lost will, and that's what kept him going.
Now, Vargas says his grief feels bigger than him. It's a call to protect meatpacking families that aren't that different from his. from the trauma of COVID-19.
And it's painful for me. Can't imagine what it's like for the family members and for the sons and daughters of workers.
Nebraska doesn't release information about individual businesses, but nearly 3,500 workers have gotten sick, with 14 deaths. The Children of Smithfield and other organizers say they'll keep speaking out until working conditions improve for their parents. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's food and rural issues. You can follow the reporting at harvestpublicmedia.org.
It was an incredible honor in 2014 to be at the White House to be awarded the National Humanities Medal. And I felt that the inscription, which meant so much to me, that the medal was for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. To me, this showed that in the years in which On Being has been in the world and growing up on public radio, our culture has also come to a place where we're ready to develop a vocabulary of the mysteries of human existence. I think that we understand together a bit better than we did even 10 years ago, that these questions of what it means to be human and who we will be to each other are also going to underpin the flourishing of all of our other disciplines, how we create neighborhoods, how we create policies, how we build schools and prisons and hospitals, and how we are as parents and neighbors and citizens. I'm Krista Tippett. I hope you'll join me for On Being, Sunday nights at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with Hunger Free North Dakota coordinator Karen Ahrens about how the pandemic has affected demand for food pantries. And our news director Dave Thompson will talk about issues of interest in today's primary voting. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. It's an unusual primary election for North Dakota. It's being conducted solely by mail ballot. Governor Burgum signed an executive order waiving the requirement that each county would have to have at least one in-person polling place due to the coronavirus pandemic. The ACLU of North Dakota says it makes sense. Dane DeCray is the ACLU of North Dakota's advocacy director.
We don't think there are the safeguards available yet to ensure the safety of all North Dakotans. And so we think it's a good idea to have vote by mail today. Now, the situation may change for the general election, but as far as today's primary, we think the safest solution is vote by mail.
Some opponents of vote by mail have claimed it could be ripe for voter fraud, but DeCray disputes that.
There's no evidence that it is ripe or fraught with fraud. We haven't seen that. It's been allegations before, but across the country, in almost, unbelievable numbers, vote by mail is a safe, secure way to be able to cast your ballot.
Minnesota health officials say two people in their 20s who died from COVID-19 did not have underlying health conditions. They were the first deaths in that age range. Both were from the Twin Cities metro area. State Infectious Disease Division Director Chris Erzman says the deaths of otherwise healthy young adults are concerning, even as overall hospitalizations for the disease are declining in Minnesota.
That is very sobering. So I think that, we take encouragement anytime that the numbers, look better. But by the same token, we're still monitoring things. This is a new virus, and so we're continuing to be cautious in how we're viewing things.
Minnesota has seen nearly 1,200 deaths due to COVID-19. The majority of the deaths have been in people over 80. And the chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation says so far banks have weathered the economic crisis brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. Jelena McWilliams held a virtual meeting with North Dakota and South Dakota bankers today. She says this is much different from the recession in 2008 because the loans have been more on solid footing and the banks are well capitalized.
We've been monitoring both these banks and just generally banks that have heavy exposures in industries that have been particularly impacted by the pandemic, banks in the oil and gas sector, banks in the farming sector, banks in the hospitality that have high concentrations, in the hospitality and tourism sectors. And so far, they have been able to withstand the shock. They're working with their borrowers. They're offering forbearances. They're modifying these loans. But they are very proactively engaging. And I think that has helped.
McWilliams says early on, as businesses closed and people self-quarantined, some people were pulling their deposits out of the banks. She says FDIC wants to assure depositors that banks are safe.
You do not need to pull your money out of the banks because you're concerned about the stability of the banks. Even if a bank fails, the FDIC stands behind the insured deposits and we will pay you out.
As for the Paycheck Protection Program, McWilliams says the banks have handled those loans very well and they're backed up by the Federal Small Business Administration. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by Karen Ahrens. She's a coordinator for Hunger Free North Dakota. She joins us by phone. Karen, thanks for being with us today.
Hello, Doug, and thank you for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
Can you describe the mission and the composition of the coalition, the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition?
Our coalition is here to work together. We're a statewide network of organizations, state agencies, businesses, and individuals working toward our vision of a hunger-free North Dakota. Our coalition members range from our typical organizations that you think about, like the Great Plains Food Bank, to faith-based organizations, groups that farm and provide food for other organizations, and the state agencies who implement the federal programs to help get food to people.
So how does it do its work?
We have at least monthly meetings, and during the last few months have been meeting a little more frequently to make sure that we're up to date in the response to the increased needs for food and food assistance, which we're noticing across the U.S. and even in North Dakota. We meet by telephone, our meetings are open, and as we have been meeting most frequently remotely, we just continue to do that throughout the time when it was harder to bring people together.
How is hunger defined by your organization?
We follow the definitions used by the United States Department of Agriculture. The main definition of food insecurity is access to enough food every day for a healthy and active life. Hunger is a term that is used more frequently, maybe more easily understood, but it's more than the feeling you get when it's an hour before lunchtime and we all feel hunger. But food insecurity is when we're not able to respond to our body telling us that we're hungry and be able to find enough healthy food for ourselves and our families.
How would you characterize the demographics of the people who are hungry in North Dakota, the ages, the gender, those kinds of things?
Prior to 2020, the groups of people most impacted by not having enough means to find enough food are families with a single parent, especially mothers and children, are most impacted by food insecurity in our state. Over these last 3 months, those things have changed as people who never before have had to seek assistance for food have been furloughed or have had their jobs, the places where they work, closed down or their jobs been discontinued. So we are seeing more and different people who are finding the need to help make sure they have enough food to feed their families and themselves.
So what does that mean in terms of perhaps the percentage of people in North Dakota who need this kind of assistance?
In North Dakota, there is not one organization with the capability or the resources financial to do a survey, a statewide valid survey of people. But what we do have are indicators. There have been some nationally representative surveys in April 2020, which showed that across the U.S., food insecurity doubled overall and tripled among households with children. What we can see here in North Dakota is we know that between March and May 2020, more than 100,000 North Dakotans filed for unemployment insurance. We have the Great Plains Food Bank reporting at least a 44% increase in visits to their partner food pantries and soup kitchens. We have had an increase in the number of people who have applied for and are receiving SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, SNAP benefits in North Dakota by at least 10%, and we think it's going to be closer to 20%. The North Dakota Department of Commerce did a survey of more than 11,000 North Dakotans, and 44% of the North Dakotans who completed that survey stated that hunger and food insecurity is an issue of concern in their communities. So those are all signs to us that since March of 2020, there are increased needs for resources to find food in North Dakota.
Has that affected the availability of food? The Great Plains Food Bank is a principal source. It provides food for pantries and soup line kitchens and things like that. Is the food there for distribution?
For right now, they've been able to meet the need. I know that some orders that they've placed through Feeding America, their national partner, won't be getting here for a few months. We know that in some of our rural grocery stores, they've had an increased business. Some are doing double the business that they would normally have done. And they've reported they haven't gotten complete orders in and or delays in some of the food orders. And I think people who listen to Prairie Public and Public Radio know that there have been events that have impacted our food supply, from the meat processing plants that have had to shut down because workers tested positive, to farm workers and farmers who have not maybe been able to harvest, not enough hands to harvest or be able to get the food shifted from going to restaurants to grocery stores because we shifted all of a sudden where we were getting our food.
Is there any need to ration at this point, or are there shortages in particular products, or are people getting what they need?
I would say for some people, they might find some particular products not there on their on the store shelves when they go. We're paying attention to it, but there is not any call for that type of action. But there is a call for all hands on deck, including efforts in North Dakota to make more connections between the people who grow our food here locally and the places who sell and distribute it locally. We have this great history in North Dakota of people who have gardened, who have hunted and fished for their food. Those are important. Community gardening is an important mechanism. And if you plant some, it might be, we're getting to the time when it's, we got to get those gardens in. But if you are able to plant a little extra to share with your neighbor, all these different food sources, I believe, are stepping up and need to step up to make sure that we all have enough to eat.
Who qualifies for help? Can anybody go to a pantry or do you have to show something?
The different food pantries in different communities, some will ask for some paperwork or showing of need by the people who go there, and other places do not. It just depends on the food pantry or the program that is providing the assistance.
Karen Ahrens is a coordinator for Hunger Free North Dakota. This is a coalition of organizations that work to provide food to people in the state who are going hungry otherwise. Karen, in previous discussions, we've talked about food deserts in various areas of the state where grocery stores have closed and it's maybe a little harder to distribute food to people in need. Is that a particular challenge during this time of pandemic? Is there any accommodation that's been made? Are things more or less difficult?
Just like many other things that the COVID pandemic has exposed and made worse, there are certain regions of North Dakota where food insecurity rates were higher prior to this. So when you start off already finding it more difficult to access food, this all makes it worse. And some of those places include our indigenous communities, our Indian country in North Dakota. But for example, the Great Plains Food Bank has increased their number of stops of their mobile food pantries to our tribal areas in the state, upping those deliveries to once per month. There have been private organizations and companies who have stepped up to help get food to the areas most impacted. There's now a new USDA program that will operate at least through June called the Farmers to Families Food Box. It's also being carried out by the Great Plains Food Bank.
So the work of the coalition has been affected a bit by the pandemic. Have the lessons learned perhaps indicated some tweaking in the way you do your business in the future?
Sure. I think that, for example, rural grocery stores have proven their importance to the people that live in the rural areas of our state, and they have experienced people shopping at them more, and their managers and supporters and owners, and some of them are community owned, really hope that people will continue to shop there and support them, because without that support year round, they can't just be there for people when there's a blizzard or when there's a health emergency. So I think we are just doubling down on the ways to help make sure that our rural grocery stores can stay open. Partners all across the state are stepping in to work even harder to create those connections between local food producers and grocery stores, local food producers and school and farm-to-school programs, connecting local growers to food pantries and other places across the state. So that work we see as even more important, and we're trying to find the resources to make those connections happen.
Is this something that might require legislative action? Is there some sort of policy that the state government might be able to facilitate the distribution of food more equitably or more easily across the state?
In an interim commerce committee, the rural grocery store effort is being examined. When we bring this information to them to show them that perhaps these rural grocery stores can be considered as infrastructure, like roads, like public water utilities, that them being there to make sure people can access food, I think if they can hear that and understand the importance of those, that hopefully the legislature can give that support.
Karen Ahrens is a coordinator for Hunger Free North Dakota. She's also a health and nutrition consultant and a registered dietitian, and as you just heard, a policy advocate. Karen, on the website for Hunger Free North Dakota, which is hungerfreend.org, there's this statement: "We are daring to ask the question, can we eliminate hunger in our state? Few other states are closer to this goal than North Dakota." How close is North Dakota, and how will we know when we're hunger-free?
That was written before COVID-19, so we continue to strive toward that. But like the pandemic, once we are able to reduce the number of transmissions, we're at a number of cases that can be handled are very low, it will never go away, but we need to maintain and sustain the efforts to make sure that people can access the food they need. And since you mentioned our website, hungerfreend.org, we're trying to make sure that it's really easy to help people find food that they need. So by visiting our website, they can link right away to the list of food pantries and soup kitchens in the state, to find out how to apply online for SNAP, to find out more about the programs in the state, which are doing a great job at adjusting the way they do things and making meals through home delivery and curbside pickup available to our older North Dakotans, how to apply for the WIC program, the program that helps people have food and nutrition education for women and children up to age 5. And how people can find food for children during the summer through an interactive map. So if you know of someone or you are looking for help yourself, hungerfreend.org can help get you pointed in the right direction.
Karen Ahrens is coordinator for Hunger Free North Dakota. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for your interest, and I appreciate your time too. And thank you, Prairie Public.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. And before we leave the show today, we're going to check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, because, Dave, we've got a pretty big primary going on, as it turns out.
We certainly do. It's basically the big thing is some of the contested races and also, of course, the city and school board and county officials that are being elected today, too.
Well, I noted that statewide, they were looking at the potential for this being the biggest primary in years, if not ever. And I know in Cass County, right, they're looking at it similarly.
I know in Cass County, you've got the interesting phenomenon of approval voting, which could be very interesting when the results finally come in. You know, Fargo is kind of a pace setter in terms of approval voting. It's been talked about a little bit in some other cities, but Fargo actually implemented it this time. And I think a lot of people are watching to see what's going to happen.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it was kind of interesting to do that voting, particularly for the city commission, because that's all ranked. And of course, you get to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or something like that. So we'll see how the weighted vote turns out.
That's right. And of course, there really aren't measures on the ballot, but I think there are a couple of things that you're looking for in their Republican Party contests for nominations. For example, there's been a lot of money that's been spent on the treasurer's race, of all things. You've got Thomas Beadle from Fargo, state representative, running against a state representative who's basically one of the Bastiat caucus, Johnston from Catherine, North Dakota, who is a they're both interesting folks, and they're both basically trying to out-conservative each other, which is fun to watch.
It's been a lot of money spent on the state treasurer position. I have personally received something like 10 pieces of cardstock election, if you will, advertising, particularly for Beadle and for the voting in the primary, too, in general. But I was intrigued by that because, of course, that's the governor's money is partly in that particular effort.
Right. And you've got that PAC that was formed by some of Governor Burgum's associates that seem to be backing Beadle. And then you've got the other group backing Johnston. And it was interesting because Johnston received the endorsement from Donald Trump, whereas the other person, Beadle, received the endorsement from Doug Burgum. Now you go to the race in District 8, the two legislative races, the two Daves, who are trying to unseat Jeff Delzer, and both Kevin Kramer, who got the endorsement for Johnston for treasurer, and Doug Burgum have endorsed the two Daves. It's an interesting thing to watch, and I've seen an awful lot of advertising for that District 8 race.
Well, the governor has an issue with Delzer, doesn't he?
Certainly, because Representative Delzer, as chairman of House Appropriations, told the governor that we're not going to bother with your budget. We're going to write our own. And he kind of poo-pooed the governor's budget. And I think the governor has some, you know, he's a little annoyed by that because, you know, the governor is supposed to propose and the legislature disposes. That's the way it's set up. But Jeff Delzer said we're going to go our own way on it. So there's a bit of bad blood that goes back a few years between the two.
Well, that Dakota Leadership PAC, which has all of the governor's money in it, and he has lots of money, and this is kind of a unique circumstance in North Dakota politics where you've got a governor with a lot of resources who has really decided to, take on a piece of the supermajority that runs the state. Of course, it's pretty much a Republican state, and he's looking to build his faction, I guess.
I guess you're right. And what also in the District 8 race is that the two Daves, as we call them, are basically supported by the coal industry, too. And the coal industry, as you know, and we've been doing a lot of report on it, seems to be in a less than advantageous position these days, you know, with the potential closing of the Coal Creek Station in 2022 and one other power plant that's been taken offline. And coal seems to be not as cheap as it was when you talk about producing electricity. And it looks like wind is coming up, natural gas is coming up, and potentially nuclear from those who use the electricity in Minnesota.
Which raises the question, whoever wins the election is going to have to deal with that transition issue for those coal counties in North Dakota that will be deeply affected by those closings and the shift in the energy supply business.
Right. And there's a whole other issue that we've been reporting on about, you know, coming up with carbon capture strategies. There's the Project Tundra. Then there's the new project at Coal Creek that would be storing carbon dioxide for use in the Blue Flint ethanol production process. And they all say this is probably going to help the coal industry out because it becomes a more attractive fuel if you can get some of the carbon out of it.
The complication there, though, is that that involvement in, you know, basically paying coal-fired power plants to sequester CO2 or use it in some other way is a form of subsidy. And that's the argument that's going to be placed out there because subsidies for energy have been political ploys for a long time. And, of course, wind power and solar have their supporters as well.
That is correct. I think nuclear does not right now. And we're not talking nuclear for the state of North Dakota, but, you know, Xcel Energy still uses and is going to rely on nuclear power as part of its mix for many years to come. So there's an awful lot of chess pieces at play in this, which is interesting. The one race we didn't talk about was DPI. I don't know if you're going to go there, but the Department of Public Instruction, because yes. You've got Kirsten Baszler, who's being challenged by two people. One is the Underwood School Superintendent, and one is Charles Tuttle, who's been a conservative activist for a while, and he's tried some other races in the past, and now he's running for DPI.
Well, Kirsten Baszler has that name recognition, and, you know, she's been out there quite prominently during the pandemic response by the state, so one would have to think that she might have a bit of an edge.
Might, and she is the incumbent. She's been elected a couple of times, and she seems to be pretty popular, but, you know, it could be interesting. It could be because that's a no-party race. You're just running for the letters of support, basically, or running so that the top two will get into the November election. It could very well be Baszler versus Tuttle or Baszler versus the person from Underwood, which could be kind of fun.
Well, let's talk just for a minute here. We've got a minute left here about that interesting bit of endorsement that you referred to earlier in this primary election day. Trump is the person who's actively endorsing the treasurer candidate, David Johnson, and Trump is all over the governor's endorsed candidate, Thomas Beadle. I mean, they're both invoking the Trump name as part of their campaign strategy.
It is interesting, and of course, they're also talking about which one is the true conservative. I find that very interesting, and this is one that will probably be studied for a little bit by some political science folks after the fact.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, whenever the occasion arises, and of course, a primary election like the one we're seeing is a good time to chat about the business. Thank you, Dave.
You're very welcome.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 9th. In the early spring of 1910, Theodore Roosevelt was being courted by Governor L.B. Hanna and others to allow a statue of Theodore Roosevelt to be erected in North Dakota. The statue was to be sculpted by noted Norwegian sculptor Gustav Vigeland. The location proposed was the campus of the North Dakota Agricultural College, today's NDSU. Extolling T.R. as the statue's subject, Hanna mentioned his Western connections, his prideful references to his early days in the territory, and his appreciation for the Badlands. Two back-and-forth letters ensued, and Roosevelt's answers offer insight into his character. He wrote, quote, I hope I need not say how pleased and touched I am by this proof of interest in and friendship for me by the people of North Dakota. Naturally, I feel a peculiar pride in having their goodwill, for I was a resident in the state in territorial days, and there are few things in my life that I look back to with more satisfaction. I do not think it would be wise to erect a statue of me. I think it is hardly ever wise to erect a statue to anyone until he is dead. In the next place, there are so many statues I would rather see erected upon college grounds or in public parks in North Dakota than any statue of an individual. Continuing to quote from Roosevelt, I should like to see a statue of the pioneer commemorated, a cowboy, a farmer, a train hand, a really first-class statue of each of these representing the state, what it is, would be much better than any individual. Of course, don't have one unless it is good, and very, very good at that, nothing cheap or second-rate. But the pioneer farmer, the man of the wheat fields, the cowpuncher or sheep herder, the man who handles the trains out in the open. With hearty thanks, I am very truly yours, Theodore Roosevelt. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Steve Stark. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Producing vaccines can take years, even decades. Scientists are aiming for a coronavirus vaccine in less than a year.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
We're in it to win it, buddy. Never fear.
But to meet that goal, they'll have to ramp up production before it's even certain a vaccine is effective.
We have a lot of confidence based on what we've seen so far in our animal modeling. The vaccine will work.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Tomorrow on our show, long delays in naturalization ceremonies mean no voting come election time for many new Americans. We'll discuss that and other issues arising from the pandemic with immigration attorney Anna Stenson. And banks are facing challenges too. We'll talk about banking in a time of pandemic with Rick Clayburg, President and CEO of the North Dakota Banking Association. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.